Okay, the time is 8:33 a.m. on July 27, 2021, and I am convening this video conference meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act, Governor Abbott's suspension of certain Open Meeting Act requirements due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and the association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on July 16, 2021, and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. Copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved as all 8 appointed directors have been confirmed as attending by video or audio conference. One director position remains vacant, and Jim Harrison is not yet connected, but he will be on in just a little bit. Also in attendance are Board Counsel Shelby Betts, General Counsel Jackie Rickson, Executive Director Bart Bowles, and Association employees Jarrett Terry and Topping Haggerty. From the Texas Department of Insurance, we have John Peters, James Kennedy, Brian Rewey. And that is it. Okay. So the first item on the agenda, number one, is consideration and possible action on consent agenda items, which are a summary of the official minutes and a ratification of the payment of NOLGA's fees and expense billing.
Do you need a
Ted, I move.
motion?
Yeah, we need a
This
motion.
is Dean. I
I think
move
Ted beat
approval.
me.
Yeah, I move.
Okay, so we had Ted Kennedy and Patty McCanless. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Thank you very much. On to agenda item two, Texas Department of Insurance. Oh, John Peters does not have any comments. Has that changed, John?
No, it's same. I have no comments.
Okay. So then on to item number three, consideration of possible action regarding the report on the implementation of recent corporate governance enhancements. And this is turning it over to Bart, I believe.
Yes, thank you, Jim. This is a quick follow-up on some direction from the board on actions they had asked me to take in the April meeting. There are three items. One was, yes, I'm sorry. Okay. One of the items was a letter they asked that I draft summarizing the actions of taking that the board had taken in response to James Person's October 2nd, 2020 letter. And this response to Mr. Person did lay out an overview of those actions taken by the board. I prepared the letter. It was signed by Jim Lewis as chair of the board and Ted Kennedy as chair of the Corporate Governance Committee. And it was emailed to James Person on May 10th, and there's been no response to the letter. The second item, I worked with James Kennedy, John Alexander, John Peters, the whole crew from TDI to review the PowerPoint slides that we use for the board of director of new board of director appointees for orientation. These were the revised slides that the board and the corporate governance committee had developed to reflect some additional items on the role and duties of general counsel and board counsel, and then also on the fiduciary obligations of directors. So I worked with TDI to talk through and develop some of the additional information on receiverships and the role of TDI in the receivership process and the commissioner supervision of the Guaranty Association. So We agreed on some basic revisions to the slides. I think they were very much on point and not overwhelming in length. So that slide deck is now completed. It's ready whenever the next board member is appointed. The third item is the development of a portal for the board of directors. And that portal would be used to hold governance materials and possibly other information to be disseminated to the board. In the governance materials, it will also include the PowerPoint new director orientation slides. I've begun working with our outside network consultant on options for that portal and how to build it. We needed to wait just a little bit for our conversion from on-premise servers to a full cloud environment to be completed. That was just completed in mid-May. So this process is underway now. I anticipate that the portal will be up and running, and there'll be instructions sent to all the board members for access prior to the October meeting. And Chair Lewis, though, that's all I have to report on this item.
Okay. So on to item number four, consideration and possible action on reports and recommendations from the personnel committee.
Hold on just a second. All right, I'm sorry. I had something else going on at the same time. So yesterday the personnel committee met and we talked about several things on our agenda. The first thing we talked about was some salary benefits that are provided to the association employees. And we talked about renewal of the health, dental, group life, AD&D, and long-term disability policies. Bart, did you want to go into any detail on that, or we're just going to tell them that they've been renewed?
I think the only thing, Rob, is just to mention there was a small change in coverage under the health plan and about 11% premium increase and no change to the dental coverage, 4% premium increase there, and then absolutely no change in coverage or rates on the other two insurance coverages.
Yeah. Okay. So that was good. We also discussed leave time, because you may remember that last year we had agreed to amend the handbook to allow employees to carry over up to 80 hours of vacation in 2020 because of COVID. They weren't able to utilize their vacation time. And we made that specific to just 2020, but this year, since COVID is not going away like we had all hoped, in fact, it sounds like it's coming back, we as a personnel committee thought that we should probably go ahead and extend that for 2021 as well, just to, give those employees, since they're not able to utilize their vacation due to COVID restrictions, they'll be able to keep that vacation to roll over into next year, where hopefully things will be better and they'll have an opportunity to use it. So we do have a resolution that we recommend, and we would like to present it to the board for their consideration and possible adoption. And this resolution is on adjustment to the vacation leave year-end carryover. So we would like to increase that to 80 hours. So I guess, do we need a motion on that? Are we waiting after the report?
Jim, I believe that was Dean.
Yeah, do we have a second?
Second.
James.
Huckabee, okay, any discussion?
Mr. Chair, it's Ted Kennedy. Just a quick question.
Yeah.
So the 80 hours roll is on an annual basis. Does that mean then that those hours carried forward will be used in the consecutive year, or is it possible that if staff would be able to roll 80 hours each year, building up a cash.
Just to clarify, the action at year end 2020 did not amend the employee handbook. It just adjusted that policy for 1 year to allow 2020 to have the carryover vacation leave increased from 40 hours to 80 hours. What the committee is recommending is the same change at year end 2021, but only for year end 2021. The handbook will still have the policy that only 40 hours can be carried over at year end in subsequent years. So this is, you know, a one year at a time consideration. Those hours will carry over. So employees, I will tell you right now, all employees that are on staff right now will have more than 80 hours will carry over and can use it in the next year. If we get to the end of 2021 and there's been no change in the policy again, the limit will be at 40 hours. There also is a limitation in the employee handbook that no employee can take more than 2 weeks of consecutive leave time without my approval. So it does allow us to coordinate to make sure we cover all activities without someone being gone for 3, 4, 5 weeks consecutively. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Thanks.
Yeah. Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
So we've been encouraging our employees to take vacation, however they do it, even if they're staying at home, just so that they're not working nonstop all year. Why do we want to not encourage employees to take vacation?
Jim, we're still going to encourage them. I can tell you right now, even with these 80 hours, your three staff are all going to drop 2 to 3 weeks of vacation leave at the end of this year anyway.
Okay.
The spring has been extremely busy with the in-house administration of business we've been doing. The change in staffing and the move of the office, there has not been the opportunity to take any time off. And now with the COVID flare-up increasing, it's just difficult. Even if people and staff, we are going to try to take vacations this year, we're definitely not going to use up anywhere close to this carryover.
Okay. I'm not saying we shouldn't do this. I'm just saying, you know, even if you're taking staycations, it's better than being at work. You need to encourage people to take time off. We had our employees take time off when they were working from home last year. So it's still time not working.
I will do that, Jim, and encourage it. There's still just going to be a lot of time accrual.
Okay. Any more discussion? Okay, we need to vote. So all in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay.
We also discussed in the personnel committee yesterday the filling of that newly created staff position. As you may remember, earlier this year, we eliminated two positions, and I know that Bart worked with his staff to create a job description of the new position that would encompass those duties. And so Bart, we discussed that. Bart, did you want to talk about that? Or you just to tell them what we discussed?
I think I should summarize just a little bit for the board so they're up to speed where we are on this. With that newly created position, as you recall, it's a position that has both administrative duties and basic accounting duties. And so it's kind of a unique position. And as we began talking with the employment agency, we're trying to fill that position on a temp to perm basis. We were advised by the employment agency that the salary range that we had adopted during the compensation study last September may be somewhat outdated for the Austin market. We do have some questions about that, but they said they've seen a significant change in the Austin market in the last 3 to 4 months. And they don't believe we'll be able to find a valid candidate at the salary range we've set up. So I reviewed this with the committee and talked about what the compensation, what the employment agency had recommended. I asked the committee to allow me some discretion to work within the existing salary range and not to change the salary range for that position. Then also work with the employment agency to make sure they understand the job duties of this position and our expectations for the type of candidate we're seeking, and see if we couldn't fill the position within those parameters. Thinking it'd be premature to just respond and start changing that position based on the comments from this employment agency. So that is one direction we are going to pursue. But coupled with that, I have asked Topping to contact the employment agency and postpone looking at any candidates right now. I'll report later that there's some change in the COVID environment in Austin. We're going to make some changes in our office. And it's difficult to bring in a new staff, especially in this position, and train them remotely. So we feel we can still get the work done. It's a little bit extra burden on Jarrett and Topping, but we're going to postpone filling this position until we see if the COVID situation settles somewhat. So, and Robin, that's the only update I wanted to provide to the board, ask them if they wanted to provide me with any feedback or direction.
Okay, thank you, Bart. The Personnel Committee also did a review of the elements of Bart's contract with the association. We discussed, you know, his annual performance evaluation. Shelby will distribute to all the board members in December of this year and accumulate those responses and prepare a compilation of results that will be distributed to the committee and the board of directors during the January meeting. We also discussed any other engagements Bart's considering during the January. We will discuss any other engagements during the January 11th personnel committee meeting. We talked about the annual cost of living, which is made automatically to Bart's base compensation based on the Social Security Administration COLA for 2022 benefits, if any. Bart told us that I think right now they've kind of indicated that it might be trending at a little over 5%, because as we know, everything's gotten much more expensive in the past several months. We talked about our 457B contributions that'll be made at the end of January 2022. That's part of our contract with Bart. The only part is that there is a discretionary amount that could be considered based on his performance. And his contract also has a longevity incentive payment, but that next one is not scheduled until December 2023. So the committee didn't have to take any action on that until, you know, for another 2 years. But no actions were necessary on that reporting item. Bart updated us on the management and staff training. He continues to ensure that he and his two employees, currently two employees, stay up to date on training. So Bart, did you want to talk about that or just want to move on to the next?
I think there's not much to say.
Okay. We reviewed the committee's calendar and we had a brief conversation in executive session, and Bart updated us on his interview with the Kentucky Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association's executive director position. And that was pretty much the report for the personnel committee for July. Any questions?
Robin, if I could, I had a typo in the summary I sent to you. It said we reviewed the calendar. Yes, you did review your calendar, but one thing I didn't write in there clearly is the committee did do its annual review of its charter, and the committee had no recommended changes to the charter. Just want to make sure we have a good record that the committee performed the duty.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Bart.
Did I zone out and miss the Juneteenth discussion?
You did not zone out. That is something that we discussed, and I failed to mention it. So, yes, we are. We did have some discussions. Of course, that holiday won't occur until June of 2022. So we didn't feel like it was necessary to take any action on any recommendation regarding that at this particular committee meeting or this board meeting. I think it's something that we discussed, maybe checking to see what the Texas Department of Insurance is going to do, other associations, or maybe how they're going to handle it as far as adding it to their holiday calendar for their employees and reviewing the total number of holidays we offer to our employees and deciding, do we want to add this 12th holiday or do we want to switch it out for something else? But that's a conversation we're just going to have at a later date.
Okay. My company added it. I just saw it on the notes, so I was curious about it.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that because I forgot about it, but you're right, Jim. It's just, it is something that the board will need to consider after, like I said, we were going to kind of just check around and see what other people are doing.
Does anybody have any questions for the personnel committee? Okay, thank you, Robin. I guess it's on to agenda item number 5, the assessment investment committee meeting.
Could we postpone having this discussion of item 5 until Jim Harrison joins?
Oh, yeah.
Let's move on to 6. And that's also executive session and kind of like Jim to hear that. So if we could take this out of order and move on to item 8, if you don't mind.
Oh, yeah. So the item 8 quarterly report from Bart.
Yes. Okay, I have a couple of things to just mention that I believe might be worthwhile. I'll start with our COVID response plan. As I previously reported, our goal was to monitor what the health risk guidelines for the city of Austin were. And as those were released and amended, that we would resume operating and open the office. So after we moved in May, I began coming in every day and I've been here every day since. But Jarrett and Topping have been coming in weekly for 1 or 2 days as they need to address hard copy mail and things in the office. But then on July 6th.
Well, we've been coming in 3 days a week.
Well, starting on July 6th.
Oh, okay. Yeah, correct.
I was just getting there. Then on July 6th, we opened the office to what we call our new hours, where Topping and Jarrett would both come in the office 3 days a week, and they would alternate those days in such a way to minimize how many people are in the office. The only day that we've all been in the office has been Wednesdays. So we review collaborative projects and just coordinate on Wednesdays. Last week, on the 23rd, the city of Austin increased its risk level to level 4 for COVID and has recommended that people stay home. And if they have to go out in a public area, to wear masks, and even those that are not vaccinated, wear masks indoors anytime. So with that, I'm going to be moving our office back to our pre-July 6th situation. So I will continue to come in the office and maybe work some days from home. It's just there's not a lot of traffic here, so there's nobody coming in the office. And then Jarrett and Topping will only come in the office maybe as much as 1 day a week or 2 days if they need
Bart,
a high volume of mail.
Hey, Bart.
Yes.
I just wanted to note that Jim Harrison just came on the call.
Okay. Welcome, Jim.
We Sorry, skip Mike. Ahead.
We skipped ahead to item 8 to do the executive director report, and then we can go back and catch up the assessment investment committee report after this.
That's good. Thanks.
Okay, so that's where I'm intending to move the office for COVID. Everything still gets done. It's just we're not in the office every day. The annual report was completed, and after approved by the board, it was emailed to Chief Deputy Commissioner Doug Slate on April 30th. Doug sent me a thank you and acknowledgement of receipt. So we have posted the annual report on the website and it's available for download. We did not produce hard copy printed versions and mail out to, there's roughly a list of about 80 something people we mail it out to each year. We never get questions for that. and it's available electronically, so we just saved the cost this year. The summary document was revised and submitted to, again, Chief Deputy Commissioner Slape on June 2nd. And I had a call with some of the TDI representatives, Jackie and I did, to review some changes. We agreed there was one sentence that we drop out and then minimize the change to the summary document to just have two changes. The new address, mailing address for the association, and the new mailing address for TDI. And with that, I received an email from John Alexander on July 9th, stating that July 1st, Doug Slape had approved that summary document. The 9th was a Friday, so on Monday, Topping and Jarrett, with a little help from me, we printed, stuffed, and mailed 1,088 letters to member companies. And there's, of course, the normal routine of some being returned and a lot of phone calls. And primarily, we have property and casualty companies saying, why am I getting this? You know, they're member companies based on their authority to write business in their certificate of authority. So they are members. We give them this notice. So it takes a little bit of explaining. Hopefully, this is the last time we have to do a distribution like this by hard copy mail. We have, if I could move on to talk about director positions, we have three directors whose terms are expiring September 30th, Robin Vincent, David Summer, and Jim Harrison. And all three are very aware of that. I've also made Caitlin Merrick at the TDI aware of those. I believe Robin, she's already noted because she mentioned to me and says, I don't believe Robin is going to continue past the expiration of her term. And I confirmed that for her. David and Jim, I've not said anything to Caitlin, so she may be reaching out to her, or if you'd like her contact information, you can feel free to reach out and express your desires either way to continue or end your service. I urge you to continue, please. The Commissioner of Insurance position remains vacant. And I know Jackie always has good inside information, but I'll ask you, Jackie, from what I hear, I don't believe anything is in consideration right now.
I haven't heard of anything either, Bart. So,
while special sessions of the TD of the legislature may continue for a while, during that period, it's kind of predicted that we probably won't see a commissioner until legislative sessions end. Office relocation. I put in your materials some of the costs that we incurred to move the office. You can see that our office build out, we were able to complete for $2,700, our piece of the build out. Now, the build out was over $130,000, but our piece after negotiation was only $2,700. And then some of the other costs we incurred. So the cost really, the move cost us about $28,000, and we had budgeted $30,000. So we came in reasonably within budget there. We also budgeted another $8,000 for some additional furniture. We spent $4,100 of that. So I think this was a beneficial move. I'll add that comparing monthly lease expense and parking payments, our last payment at the old office in May, we paid $24,329.46. And the August invoice that we're paying today in the new building is the first month with the full lease payment, is $13,759.84. So a little more than $10,500 per month in reduced cost. So almost $127,000 annually in reduced lease expense. So it is a lesser building. It's a very clean, safe building. We cut our space back from 4,100 square feet to a little over 2,700. So it's much smaller, but we fit. So I think those cost savings, you know, speak for themselves. I don't think there's anything else to say on the office, unless Jared or Topping, you guys think I've missed something.
I have nothing.
Okay. So I mentioned that we completed our migration to the cloud environment in mid-May. It took a little bit of work. It took a lot longer than anticipated, but it's working without a hitch. And we do have remote connectivity to all our files. So it's much easier to access our systems. We don't have to do remote desktops. So with that, we will be setting up access for Jim Lewis and one or two members of the executive committee, or if you so desire, all members of the executive committee. So if you need to access any of the materials we have in our records, because a lot of our network records are referenced in some of the reports, especially the report I did last year on our critical operations and critical functions, you will have access to get to that information. So that is being developed now, and I hope to have that set up by the October meeting. And then the last operational item, with the completion of the cloud migration project, we now have everything stabilized in our network environment, and we are gathering proposals from firms to do a network penetration and social engineering testing. So we will have those proposals in hand for the audit committee to review in October, with the hopes that we can have the testing performed this year. And the last thing I'll mention are meetings that have occurred or are on the agenda. The NEIC meeting is about to be held in Columbus, Ohio. I think it's unfortunate for Columbus that there hasn't been a meeting of the NEIC in Columbus in quite some time, Jim, if I'm correct. And it just so happens that this meeting is going to be a hybrid meeting. The NEIC has not done this before. So some will be attending in person, and then there will be a lot of attendees virtually. I have always attended NEIC meetings. I skipped the last meeting that was virtual. After the first one I attended in that format, did not seem very productive. And I am going to be skipping this meeting as well. I have been attending, and I have another one tomorrow, and I think the next day. Various task forces and working groups are having their meetings, which are normally during the in-person NEIC meetings. They're having them in advance and have them virtually. So you can still get all the benefit without paying those $795 in-person registration fee or the $495 virtual attending fee. So that may be changing in the future, but this is the first hybrid meeting the NEIC is going to experiment with. The NOLA legal seminar was held last week. Jarrett and I attended. Jackie and Shelby, I think you both attended. I don't know if any other directors attended. Did I miss anyone?
I was on the legal conference.
Okay, you were there. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I did. But of course, as usual, I didn't realize until I was in my fourth session that I was supposed to be responding to the polls. I had not opened it, which is my fault for not reading. Well, but I made sure to answer all the polls for the rest of it. It was good. There's a lot of good information.
Well, if you need that CLE, let me know. We can get you in touch with someone. They can confirm some things other than the polling questions and still get you your CLE. But the legal seminar, I think, went off pretty well. Several of those things, in my mind, I don't benefit from, but there were some of the discussions that were on very current, controversial issues, and the presenters were careful to kind of dance around the issues, but still get into some significant material. Especially, there was a panel on some of the current rehabilitations and some of the approaches being taken for rehabs, what I thought was very, very good. The MPC meeting of NOLGA will be held next week, August 3rd, or primarily when all the meeting will be held there. Then there's a training session for the administrators on board engagement, you know, how to keep your board informed, corporate governance issues, things like that. It'll be kind of interesting because that's going to be held as a virtual event, but then there's going to be virtual breakout sessions and we'll rejoin. And I'm going to serve as a facilitator for some of the breakout sessions. So we'll see how that does. August 3rd, I'll also be making a presentation on Senior American. And then they've asked me to do the wellness presentation, Patty, for the Penn Treaty Task Force report. So that will be next week. And the last meeting is to update you on the plans for the NOLGA annual meeting. Currently, the plans are that it will be held in person, October 26th and 27th, with an MPC meeting on the preceding day, the 25th. And it's going to be in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, that announcement was made and the contract inked with the hotel before this COVID flare-up began. I've not heard of any changes. So as far as I'm aware, it will still be in person. And Chair Lewis, unless there are questions, I have nothing else.
Any questions? And I believe we will go back to agenda item 4. Is it 4?
Yes, it is. I'm sorry, 5.
Oh, yeah, 5, which is the Assessment Investment Committee.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, sorry, I had a conflict this morning, and so sorry I joined late. Investment Committee did meet yesterday afternoon. All members, Ted, Dean, and myself were present. We reviewed the association's cash flow projections of policy obligations and expenses. These are relatively unchanged as they have been for a while. The Guarantee Association has adequate funds on hand to meet these obligations. And I guess to jump ahead on the bullets, we did not recommending a Class B assessment or related credit refund. We reviewed the association's investments. As before, they're in cash, money market funds, and the majority in laddered U.S. Treasuries held at Morgan Stanley and or J.P. Morgan. Morgan Stanley, one of the brokerages, is moving to a new electronic platform. There's some action items related to that. So I'll just put a pin in that for now and maybe do that at the end. Bart, and you can do any additional explanation there that we need. The committee reviewed the investment policy and the committee's charter. No changes were recommended. We took a look at the recent assessments and related collections and also the future assessment process. The 2020 Class A assessment, which I think was a little over $2 million, was finally closed. As the board may recall, there were some issues because of the timing and the recent adoption of the new association model legislation that brought HMOs into the mix, that some of the premiums that they had on their, I don't know what the word I'm looking for, charts or included chip premiums, which are not assessable. So Bart and Jarrett figured that all out and refunded the portion that was not assessable. I think that was, what, $12,000 roughly in refunds, but that assessment has now closed. We reviewed the 2021 Class A assessment. That's pretty much almost all been collected. There are a couple companies that haven't paid, but very small dollar amounts. So I think that one's largely done. Bart and Jarrett talked about the modernization of the assessment process. They're making some changes. We're expanding use of the existing system to make everything electronic, which I think will quicken things and make things easier after they do all the legwork. And when I'm done, Bart, if you want to provide any more detail on that, feel free. And then the kind of last two items, I guess, were both action items. I don't know, Bart, if you want to do the transfer of estate balances first. Maybe the committee reviewed a staff proposal for the transfer of certain estate net asset balances to the insolvency expense fund. And maybe Bart, I'll leave it to you to explain the criteria for selection of those balances. And I don't know if you have that resolution you could put up on the screen for folks.
I do. So what we have here, and please remember, this is not the first time we've done this review of some of the asset balances we're carrying on companies. I'm going to just give you a quick overview to truly understand this. We'd have to sit down and walk through. Here's the way we assess, we keep payment histories, and when we collect excess monies on companies, there's a way we apply those monies for the companies back as credit refunds when we do future assessments. But that's what we have here. We have funds that have been collected for a long list of companies that we're holding, and to refund them to companies through the credit refund process, you have to refund it based on their payments for the last assessment on that insolvent company. So you keep a lot of records on payment histories, on old assessments, and they go back decades to refunds these credit balances. Well, on some of those insolvencies, the monies are not very large. And also on some of those, some companies have reduced their writings in certain lines of business. So it takes many, many years to use up the application of those credit refunds when we do assessments. So we periodically review this list of companies with asset balances to see how old are some of these insolvencies and when was the last time we assessed them and how much money are we holding here? Because we look at it to see, are there possibly still premium tax offsets available to companies, or have they taken them? And if they've taken them, there's two options. You continue to hold it for a future credit refunds. You pay those refunds to the Commissioner of Insurance, or you do what we're going to be recommending here. You transfer it for use for insolvencies in the insolvency expense account. So looking at these companies, there were 18 companies that we found that were assessed, were their last assessment was prior to 2010, so more than 11 years ago. And we chose that breakpoint thinking that premium tax offsets have been taken. And those 18 companies all had positive credit balances. We also found two companies that had negative asset balances that we had never assessed for. One was a de minimis amount, around $200,000, and the other one was costs we had to research obligations for which we never had to pay any of those obligations. Another guarantee association paid it all, so we never assessed. So what we're recommending is to take those 20 companies, take those asset balances and take the net amount, transfer it to the insolvency expense account. And our motivations here are find a way to make this money work the best for all member companies and to minimize some of the administrative burden of carrying these balances for decades and decades. This does work hand in glove with some of the assessment modernization we're doing, because to fully make our assessment processes electronic, all those payment histories from all those old assessments, so hundreds of companies paying each assessment, would have to be loaded into the assessment system so the assessments calculate correctly. So twice previously, we've done a cleanup of balances like this and transferred monies. Once it was into the administrative expense fund. And the last time, a little over 2 years ago, is when the insolvency expense account was created. We transferred a number of balances into that account at that time. So what we're recommending today is transfer the net asset balance from those 20 companies. It's $39,037.19 to the insolvency expense account. How will that money be used? If the association has an insolvency that the obligations are de minimis, they really, if you end up doing the assessment, you're going to be sending out $5, $10, $15 assessments. Okay. It could just be paid and funded from the McSolvency expense account. Then we also have work that we do on monitoring rehabilitations in troubled companies. And sometimes those never are placed into liquidation and were never activated. So we can never do a Class B assessment. Those expenses could be paid because they are insolvency specific or company specific from the insolvency expense account. So those are the potential purposes. And we think this works well for the association, and it will clean up a lot of the accounting and background. And Jarrett, is there anything you want to add to this? Because you're the one that tracks all these balances.
The only thing I would say is to just kind of reiterate the point that you made that this kind of cleanup is really important due to the age of some of the data that we have. It's really important for us to move to this new or our increased use of our assessment system, because some of the data that we have for these old insolvencies back from 1992, 1994, we have the data. It's just not in shape that we can actually use to load in the system. So this would be very helpful for that purpose.
So just after discussion and questions, the committee unanimously voted to recommend the resolution Bart has on the screen to the board for consideration. So I guess on behalf of the committee, we'd urge the board to adopt the resolution there. And I don't know if I can move it as chair, but if I can, I will do so.
Jim, can I ask a question? And then I'm happy to make the motion. I just want to make sure. I mean, I completely understand why we would do this. Otherwise, it's impossible and it's not worth the effort. And some company's going to get a check for $100 years later and go, oh, whatever. But my question is, when it goes into this insolvency expense account, does that then reduce the administration assessments that the industry... I mean, is it used? Is it just sit there forever, or is it used for administrative expenses of the guarantee association?
Yeah, I'll let Bart respond more fully, but I don't think it goes to the administrative expenses because it's in the insolvency expense fund. But yes, it would reduce the cost to industry for insolvency related expenses.
That's perfect. Then I make a motion to approve the resolution.
James Huckabee, second.
Any discussion? So just to be clear, this reduces possible future Class B assessments, not Class A assessments.
That's correct, Jim.
Okay.
And I should have mentioned this before you vote, just to let you know, the insolvency expense account right now has a little over $600,000 in it. That's all that's there.
I would like to make one clarification. It can have an impact on Class A, because if we have insolvency related expenses for in a state that we could not assess for because we were not activated, those were generally paid from the administrative funds.
Oh. Okay. Any other questions or discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? Thank you very much.
All right. And then we had one more action item, as I mentioned before, that Morgan Stanley is moving to an electronic platform. I'll let Bart or Jarrett talk a little more about it, but there are some advantages to the Guarantee Association real-time account information, just streamline electronic processes. In order to use the new platform, however, Morgan Stanley requires clients to execute certain documents and resolutions. They're fairly lengthy. I think Jarrett sent them out to the board yesterday afternoon. The committee reviewed these, discussed them with Bart and Jarrett and council, and voted to recommend them to the board. So anyway, Bart, I don't know if you want to provide any more explanation, but yes, we're recommending that the board execute or issue the resolutions and execute the related documentation Morgan Stanley requires.
Jim, these are form, but I won't call them form over substance. There is some substance here, even though they're required by the brokerage firm, and there's really not much that you can change. There are some gaps and some holes that we fill in. So I'm going to make a comment about what I think this does, and then Jarrett's going to make a couple of comments about how it makes his monitoring of investments easier. And then Jackie also reviewed these documents. I'd like her to make a mention of some of the safeguards that she noted in those, in both the corporate resolutions and in the forms they're going to ask us to execute. So right now we receive monthly statements from this brokerage firm. And so we don't see the interim activities. So it's hard to really monitor where we are on some of these investments, and it's just difficult when we don't have real-time access. We have that in other banking relationships when the brokerage houses, sometimes they're slow to respond to develop some of these electronic formats. Jarrett, would you say something about how you would use this new format?
Yeah, so as Bart said, currently we kind of do our investing in, I guess you'd say, old school style. We call up our broker, we put in instructions. We do have a letter agreement in place that requires our broker to confirm any instructions that I give, and he does that through email or by calling. And so we get a statement once a month that gives us our market values at the end of the month and our cash balances. So this platform would allow us to see that in real time, to be able to plan a little bit better for our investments. And we're hoping that it will actually allow us to do or to do trades electronically, providing that we can still have the two-person rule. So it's just really going to be very helpful in providing real-time information. And we have that in our banking, and we have that with our other brokerage at JP Morgan. So Morgan Stanley is finally getting on board with the same process.
Thank you, Jarrett. And Jackie, a couple items you noted that were important in these agreements and resolutions.
Well, as Bart and Jarrett already mentioned, you know, these are pretty much take it or leave it kind of forms and documents. So you don't have a lot, or really you don't have the ability to change anything. But there are a couple of options that could have been made, which would be to have a margin account and then to have debit cards and checks. And none of those are part of the Bart and Jarrett didn't check any of those boxes. Those would not be part of it. And then on the resolution is a standard form resolution to be used by entities of any kind, and maybe even individuals as well. So there's a lot of pages in there that say things like, if the entity or the account holder is an LLC, then you fill out this section. If it's a corporation, then you fill out such and such a section. So there's a lot of pages in there that just don't even apply to the Guarantee Association, since we're not one of those kinds of entities. So I don't have any hesitation about those documents.
So Jim, hopefully that's giving you a little color about, you know, those three pages of resolutions and the 20 something pages of agreements that were shared.
Yeah. So again, after discussion with Bart and Jarrett and council, the committee unanimously voted to recommend the resolutions to the board and to recommend that we execute the related documents as described by Bart, Jarrett, and Jackie.
Okay.
Any questions? Do we have any motions?
Ted, I move.
Second, David Sommer.
Okay, that was Ted Kennedy and David Sommer. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? Thank you very much.
And schedules was the word I was desperately searching for when talking about CHIP. And other than that, that concludes my my presentation.
Anybody have any questions before we move on to item number six?
Jim, before you move on, we should mention that our attendees have expanded just a little bit. I believe that we have another person in attendance from TDI, and that's Miss Elliott. Are you there?
She left the meeting
okay.
A little while ago.
But I believe it's Missy Elliott from TDI was in attendance for a period of time there.
Okay. Well, then, are we ready to move out of regular session? Okay, the time is 9:28 a.m. on July 27th, 2021. I am recessing the regular session of the Board of Directors meeting of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association in order for the board to meet in executive session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. Okay. The time is 10:22 a.m. on July 27, 2021. The executive session of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association Board of Directors meeting has concluded, and I am reconvening the regular session of the meeting pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. And we just finished number six. Number seven, I don't believe we have anything to discuss out of executive session, so it's completed. We've already done number eight, and so we're moving on to number nine. Bart, I think you're up.
Okay, so number nine deals with our discussion of our active insolvencies. First begin with the administration summary. It's provided on 9-1 of your material, and I will bring that up on screen. Excuse me for being slow. The key here is very low benefit payments for the active companies we're running off. You know, what's reflected in here are the numbers on Penn Treaty, because they're actually, we funded that to LTC Re, and LTC Re is paying the claims to the TPA. So I'll give you those numbers in a minute. But you will see we've only paid out about $188,000 in benefits first 5 months of 2021, collected about $22,000 in premium in the same period, and recovered distributions from insolvencies of $335,000 in that period. So you can see the list on page 9-2 of the active insolvencies that we are continuing to pay obligations, and the seven troubled companies that we are monitoring that are subject to some type of rehabilitation receivership proceeding. We have obligations for active insolvencies of approximately $3.9 million. And the call summary and website activity, you'll see there's significant uptick in June 2020 in website visitors. And the call volume is remaining pretty constant, but it is higher because of Calanthe. And what's interesting, there's fewer people answering the calls. It's actually topping, answering all the calls. So she's been busy on the phone. So let me touch on a couple of the insolvencies. Calanthe Mutual, this is the small company that was converted from a fraternal before liquidation that we are continuing to administering in-house. There's 2,231 policies still in force. We provided all those policies for which we have addresses with a change of address notice for the association. We have paid 84 cash renders for $52,500, 23 death claims for a little over $28,000, and collected $10,000 in premium. This is small face amount, small premium block of business, high maintenance block of business. Requires a lot of handholding, a lot of documentation. It requires a lot of time from both Topping and Jarrett on the phone, providing calculations, obtaining the forms necessary to process and pay claims. But it's working pretty well. It's just time consuming. Next, let me touch on Penn Treaty. This is still the significant insolvency in the system right now. And I'm just going to hit a few numbers for you. So in the 52 months since this liquidation began, the Guarantee Association system has collected $397.5 million in premiums. In Texas, that's $23 million in premiums. Claims payments, $1.049 billion nationally, $57.6 million in Texas. Then the cash buyouts under the rate increase options, $130 million has been paid out nationally, and $6.5 million in Texas. So as of June 30th, there's still 43,754 policies in force nationally, 2,300 of those in Texas. And then you see the claim counts, almost 4,700 open and pending claims and 334 in Texas. I don't include all the charts here that I do in my quarterly pack of reports. What you'll see is a steady downturn, downward in the policy count, the enforced policies, but the open and pending claims are very level and very consistent, if not a slight uptick. And that's to be expected in an aging block of long-term care business, where the average age of the policyholder is 82, the average age of the policyholders on claim 87 on this block. Next, I'll just quickly report, now we're 52 months into the insolvency. Of course, if we're paying out benefits, yes, Guarantee Association limits are being reached. 760 policies nationally have reached at least 75% of the Guarantee Association limit, 31 in Texas, and then 340 nationally have exhausted their Guarantee Association coverage, 9 in Texas. Now, there's another group of policyholders that have exhausted their policy coverage. The policy benefits are actually less than Guarantee Association coverage limits, and I don't report on those. Premium rate increases are continuing. They've now been improved in all states. The last two states to be implemented, their initial rate increase were in Pennsylvania and Vermont. And then some states have multi-year phase-ins were approved by the regulators. Those are ongoing in 9 states. And then 2 states were required to submit multiple rate increases with their regulators. And those 2 states are continuing to implement second rate increases. Actually, one of those, Washington, is now is implementing its 3rd rate increase approval. So that 3rd rate increase is still the same amount as the other states did in the initial. It's just broken up in pieces. So 69,995 rate increase packages have been mailed out to policyholders. About a third of those policyholders have called with questions, but there have only been 96 complaints. Now, out of all the 70,000 rate increases that have 96 complaints, we must be communicating something right. So I think it's worked out well. The COVID variances that we've been working on since March 2020, I won't go into detail of those, but it's because of COVID, it made it difficult for the policyholders to receive some of the benefits they're entitled to under their policies. And rather than have some of these periods count against them, you have to be under continuous coverage for a certain period of time, or your waiver or premium would not be valid. Some of those had to be adjusted, because how can you be under home health care continuously if the home health care agencies won't send people to your home because of COVID? So we addressed about 145 or so variances like that. They were granted for a limited period of time. They were advised, all the policyholders involved in that. Some of them were its alternative caregivers. We were allowed a family member to serve as the caregiver. They were told that those variances were going to be expiring at the end of June. And so that's been implemented. There have been a few issues, a lot of phone calls. It's primarily just helping people get back their normal setup. So it's required a little more work on part of the TPA, but it's back in line now.
Hey, Bart.
Yes.
Did you say that the average policyholder age is 82?
Yes.
Well, I hate to be crass, but how is WarranTech ever going to matter? I mean, if it takes 20 to 30 years to close an estate, what difference does it make?
some of them, and that's 82, you know, across 46,000 policyholders. There are some younger.
Okay.
But on some of these policies, they can pay out, depending on the level of coverage, they can pay out $7,000 to $10,000 a month. So okay. Within a couple of years, 3 years max, they can hit guarantee association limits. So excess claims could come into play. And we had a policyholder in Penn Treaty that I remember when I was working on the first.
I know they're going to run out of benefit, but they're never going to get paid. I mean, we're just now paying out 30 years later on Andrew Jackson.
Well, the mechanism they were going to use, Jim, was not to pay it out at the end. They were going to pay out using this captive periodically. Okay. Every so often, they were going to value the claims and do partial distribution.
Okay.
So it was going to be along the way. A little bit different.
Okay. They'd
never done before. Okay. The next big thing going on in Penn Treaty I'll mention, and Patty's involved in this because she serves on a committee with me, it's the Wellness Initiative. And that committee, and I won't go through the entire process, but we looked at a lot of different programs. We sent out an RFP, got proposals. We trimmed it down. Finally got down to 5 proposals we were considering. But finally, we chose one vendor, a company called Assured Allies. And one of the more established wellness vendors out there. And we're working on developing a pilot program. And there's a small group of us now doing negotiations of the contract to get that in place so we can launch this program, the target date of October 1st. Now, the pilot program will initially involve only 4,100 policyholders of tax-qualified policies, and those policies have to have $200,000 or more of benefits available to them. Now, what that actually says behind the scenes is these are policyholders that have never had a claim. So 4,100 tax-qualified policies that will never have a claim. Assured Allies will use data analytics and some interactive surveying with the policyholders to help identify the policyholders that are most at risk of initiating a claim in the next 18 to 24 months. And based on that, there are a number of different interventions that will be paid for by Assured Allies with the fees we're paying them. For example, grab bars, raised toilet seats, other things like that, because those are fall preventive measures. And falls are a huge factor in this policyholder group that lead to significant claims utilization. There'll also be some counseling and training. And then also they'll be made aware of services and resources available in their communities to support them. So there's a small group of intervention measures that will be provided to these people. So there will be, this is a cost-free program for the policyholders. For any policyholder that chooses to participate, it's completely voluntary, they have no cost. And they will go through this process. And if, for example, it said we need to install grab bars in your home, they will get them for free. So the policyholders that are in the intervention group will be measured against a similar selected control group to monitor success of the program. We're also going to have, you know, feedback from the policyholders, do some surveying of them, and based on customer satisfaction of the participating policyholders, and then the financial impact comparing claims utilization from the intervention group to the control group, we will look at the effectiveness of this program. That measurement period is going to take 12 to 24 months, and that's what we call phase one. Phase two of the program will involve if we found it is worthwhile to pursue and expand this program, it will approve another 4,500 policyholders, and they will come from a non-tax qualified group of policyholders. So wellness programs are a very hot topic right now in the long-term care community. They've been used in managed care for many years, but in long-term care, they're developing. And we evaluate a lot of different options other than a program like this. There are also cognitive programs, hearing programs, medication management programs. There were a lot of different options we looked at. This one seem to fit our block the best and be the most cost effective. I know the NEIC is very, very involved in wellness programs like this right now. I attended a conference call last week where they are offered some guidance on implementation of wellness programs. And they have a draft document exposed right now for 45 days dealing with this. So you're going to hear more about wellness and this wellness program over time from me. We think it's going to benefit the policyholders significantly. And a side benefit will be cost control through reduced claims utilization and benefit utilization for the guarantee associations. So that's going to be a key element of PIN treaty moving forward. Any questions on PIN treaty? Okay, just to knock off what's left on Lincoln Memorial, there are 49 policies in Texas remaining in force, face amount, 68,000. We occasionally see a death claim come in. Where this is heading, assuming that the asset recovery litigation reaches some type of resolution, it is being developed by the task force to shut down the SDR administration of this block of business sometime in 2022. And the guarantee associations individually assume the administration of their handful remaining policies. We would bring these in-house. There are no cash surrender benefits for these policies, only death benefits. So, and they're not premium paying. So there's not a lot of administration to do, but process a claim when it arises and stay in contact with the policy owners. And that is all we will be doing on Lincoln Memorial. Northwestern National, we are continuing to administer one policy. It's an old comprehensive benefit health policy from 1972. So it's pre-major medical. It's very comprehensive. It has some general descriptions, but it has a list of several pages of specific diagnoses and treatments and the dollar amount to be paid on each one. So Jarrett is in communication regularly via text with this policyholder. It's his preferred communication method. So Jarrett is handling this policy and using the claims administration system that we have contracted to utilize from the Illinois Guarantee Association. So it helps us with the billing and of premiums and then production of EOBs on claims, because a lot of these claims are actually, it's a drug benefit. His claims are running about $9,000 a quarter. So we will continue to run off that policy. And those are the active insolvencies, Jim. They're kind of small. The one we're running off the TPA, and a couple running off in-house, and then PIN treaty. And that's a lump sum of our active insolvencies right now.
Any questions from anybody? Then I guess we'll move on to number 10.
Hey, Jen, item 10 is just to close out a couple of corporate governance issues that we deal with annually, and this is just a final report on them. The antitrust and conflicts of interest business ethics questionnaire was a little bit different this year. It was difficult getting responses. We had to follow up with a lot. We have four individuals that have not responded that we're continuing to work with, and on a couple of them, I am not getting responses to email requests that they may have left their firms. So I will continue to work on them, but these are not ongoing vendors. They were one-time vendors that we were using. I think the only ongoing vendor is the vendor that provides the administration system for our Calanthe block. And I do believe we're going to get in touch with him there. We just have to keep badgering him. So normally I can say that we've received all responses and there's nothing to report, but I have four outstanding. And I will continue to pursue them. But those four vendors are very well known, and I don't anticipate we're going to have any issues and any conflicts arise. And the last one was the Texas Ethics Commission personal financial statement filings required by all directors. Again, the Texas Ethics Commission, because of the COVID pandemic, extended the deadline this year to June 30th, 2021. I sent a reminder email to all the directors, or I sent a couple of reminder emails to all the directors, and I've not received any notification that any directors failed to file. I don't receive notifications on filings. So I am working under the assumption that all directors timely filed, and I want to say thank you. And that's all I have, Jim.
Yeah, I'd probably say, do I remember correctly that if you go off the board this year, you still have to file an ethic, the
next year
financial statement next year?
Yes. Just
want to remind people of that.
There is a form that you can file requesting an exemption. And I have that form, and it's been done a couple of times by directors that left the board. And when they got to the next year, they just said, this is when I left the board. I had no activities after that date. And they were granted exemptions. It's a case-by-case basis. So I can provide that for any director that leaves the board. It's not a long form. It's a very simple one-page statement. So, Robin, I'm keeping you in mind. And Jim, that's all I have.
Okay, and then I guess on to item number 11, the Form 990.
Yes, Jarrett prepared our Form 990 that's required annually, and this is the return of an organization exempt from income tax. And the 990, it's a very extensive form. It was revised 5 or 6 years ago. Very, very lengthy. And one of the questions on that form ask if the governing body for the entity reviewed the 990 filing. Does not require approval, does not require consent. It's just, did the board have the opportunity, or the governing body, and here it's the board of directors, have the opportunity to review the form. So Jarrett prepared the form. He has our outside accounting firm, an audit firm, Clifton Larson Allen, review that form. And then it was sent and posted separately to a confidential folder for board members to access. We would just ask if any of you have questions, let us know. It is a confidential document until filed. And once filed, it's a public document. GuideStar.com publishes 990s. I regularly review 990s for other guarantee associations and other entities on there. It's a free access. Just let you know that once this is filed, it's available to everyone.
And there were no major changes on the form this year. It's pretty much the same. There was just a small change from 1099s. But other than that, it's the same form that we've done for the last four or five years.
Okay, on to item 12. Jarrett, yes. You're going to review the financial statement.
Yeah, so let's start on page 12-2 with the statement of net position. You can see the first line there, the first note. In March, we had accumulated funds, cash money, to be able to pay the settlement. And so we paid that in April. And so you can see the change there in the cash position. There was some excess cash left over after accumulating those funds that we reinvested in U.S. Treasuries. So there, the second line, you can see under the Treasuries, they went up roughly $2 million. As you know, we did the assessment, the Class A assessment in March. And so that line there, billed assessment net of allowance with the third bullet point, that is the receivable that we booked. And so as we collect those funds, that receivable goes down. So you can see it trending over the 3 months. Down towards the bottom of the page, the next bullet there. As you recall, we implemented GASB 87 this year, which created a lease liability. Because our old lease was over in May, the balance went down to $6,000, which is roughly our remaining lease liability for our postage. So that liability has now fully amortized. We go to the next page.
Okay.
The first line there, the assessment. As you can see, in March was where we booked the original Class A assessment for 2021 of $999,947.27, which is the million that was authorized less the those that are less than $5 that we don't mail out. And then we also had the $12,000 of March 2020 Class A refunds that hit that account as well. And then in April, in the same account, we had the balance that reflects the payment of the settlement we discussed earlier. And then, the bullet point down at the bottom for the building and equipment leases, you'll see there's a negative number. This is due to us paying the May rent at the end of April, but there was no rent payment in May for June because of the new lease. And so this is a one-time issue, and this will be something that I asked the auditor to look at to make sure that that's being accounted for properly when we do the GASB 87 review. And that's all I have on the financial statements, unless there are any questions.
And Jared, why don't you go ahead and mention where we are on that GASB 87 review that the board authorized the engagement of Clifton Larson Allen?
Sure. So as Bart said, at the last meeting, the board authorized the engagement of Clifton Larson Allen to do a GASB 87 review and provide us with accounting entries and notes. Shortly after that, we provided Clifton Larson Allen with all the lease information. They have taken that and they're doing the calculations now. And so we're just waiting to hear back from them with their report. And once that's been received, we will make any adjustments to the financial statements that are warranted from that information and update the board. And that's all I have.
Anybody have any questions? Well, then I guess the next discussion is about the upcoming meeting. October 19th.
And Jim, I do have a little bit I'd like to talk with the board about on this. A couple of items. And we did have a quick discussion yesterday with the Assessment Investment Committee and the Personnel Committee. And what that was, we communicated that we have learned through the COVID pandemic and increased our capabilities to hold virtual meetings. And we would recommend that unless the committee truly wants to meet in person, that we think committee meetings could be easily conducted virtually. And if that's done, there's not a necessity to have them the day before the board meeting to minimize travel. So we ask that the committees try to schedule their meetings 2 weeks prior, at least 2 weeks prior to an upcoming board meeting. So if there are any follow-up items that will require research or investigation or pulling together information, staff has time to compile that data and distribute it to the board so they have good information and adequate time to review before the board meeting. With that being said, the Personnel Committee scheduled their next meeting for January 11th, 2022, and the Assessment Committee chose the same date. So that's a Tuesday, January 11th, 2022. The board meeting would be 2 weeks later on January 25th. So this is a slight adjustment in the scheduling and the timing of committee meetings and board meetings. That's my first comment. The second one is the use of virtual meetings, in-person meetings, or hybrid meetings. We do think that hybrid meetings are very possible with some attending in person and some attending virtually. There are a few issues that we'll have to work out on equipment. And to make sure, because the meeting would be still be held with the video conference capabilities for everyone to be seen and be heard, even those in person. So that's one thing we're beginning to work through those logistics. We think we have a pretty good plan for that. But the second thing is, for those attending in person, prior meetings, we've had most of the board, if not all the board in person, we've done a contract for a block of rooms with a hotel. It's a different story doing a contract for a block of rooms for 10 or 12 rooms compared to two rooms and getting meeting facilities at a hotel. So for the purposes of obtaining lodging for directors and making sure we have adequate meeting facilities and the location of those facilities, if we were going to do any meetings in person or a hybrid, we would have to have some advanced coordination with the directors to know who would be attending in person so we can make arrangements. We don't have a very large conference room in our current office. I think it has 8 chairs. Okay, it's not very big. We do have a conference facility in this building that's available for no charge so long as we reserve it. So that's always available. But then we could also make arrangements to use a hotel. It all depends on how many seats we need. So as we begin to look at future meetings, you will see some additional coordination and inquiries from staff about how you plan to attend. So Jim, with all that being said, it brings us to October 19th. And you and I had discussed in one of our status calls recently that October 19th would probably be the first meeting in some time that could be held in person or hybrid. That was before the variants in COVID have arisen and there's been this spike in cases and the change in the risk level here in Austin. So I'd ask the board to consider, do we need to meet in person or as a hybrid board in October? Or should we continue by virtual?
Do we need to make a decision 3 months in advance?
We'll need to make it probably at least 6 weeks in advance. And even that is going to leave us, it's going to be difficult for lodging at a hotel. I've asked Topping to go ahead and schedule the conference facility here at this building. Schedule it now. We can always cancel that, but let's grab the room and have it available. So we will have that available. So you don't have to make that decision today, but it's going to be more than just a couple of weeks out. It's going to probably, we're going to need to plan this a good 6 weeks out. So Jim, I may be reading into this that you think we should monitor the COVID situation and make this decision later.
I have a feeling that COVID is going to be something we're going to deal with for a long time. So I don't know. I'm vaccinated. I'm not that worried about it. That's just me.
Well, I'm just waiting for information to come through on the breakthrough cases. That's what worries me. But we can easily monitor this and reach back out to the board as we get closer to October. But the October 19th date, I think, is a good firm date. It's just exactly what type of meeting, we don't know yet.
Am I the only one interested in meeting in person? Or,
I was planning on attending in person. But it could be, I don't know why it wouldn't be a problem just to have it hybrid. Unless Bart feels like, unless it's so bad, Bart, that it's risky for you and everybody else for us to be together. I guess that's the case. It's just so early to know.
No, we have no problems with doing a hybrid. Our concern was we didn't want someone to want to come in person from out of town and we not be able to provide a place for them to stay or make it inconvenient for them to get to our building because, there's not a hotel close to this building.
I mean, we used to meet out in Timbuktu when your office was in, North Austin, whatever it was. And we all made our own hotel arrangements. So,
Jim, this is Ted. Just in response to your question, I'm in favor of in-person unless something significantly changes requiring us to reconsider. That said, in mindful of Topping's time to the matter, you know, the easy thing to do, similar to your complex there, Bart, is just to block some rooms and have them available. We can always cancel with no harm, no foul. I appreciate that takes Topping time to organize. So if you'd rather defer until we get closer to the situation to determine, fine with me. Just put me down as an in-person unless otherwise instructed.
We can easily block the conference room, Ted. The harder thing is going to be a hotel room.
Yeah, I was just going to suggest we go ahead and book some rooms. And if that doesn't require a whole lot of logistical activity, go ahead and have those at the ready, and we could cancel later with no consequence if needed.
Okay. We may do some informal polling to see who would be coming in from out of town and go ahead and reserve X number of rooms. We won't do a contract. We'll just reserve rooms to make sure we have a reasonable cancellation right, you know, 24 hours in advance or something.
This is James. I'm also interested in attending in person. Jim, I have a question. Since you said there's no hotel, I mean, boy, close to the office, if we are meeting in person, then would it be an option to rent a conference room or reserve it at the hotel? I know when we were doing the looking at your personnel compensation for you and those type things, we met at DFW Airport, now Loveville Airport. So just being mindful of those that might fly in from out of town, would it be awfully inconvenient to meet at a conference room at a hotel if we proceed with a in-person meeting?
I don't even remember what you told us about what the parking situation is at your new building.
There's free parking.
Okay.
The visitor parking here is free, and it's a garage behind the building. We park below the building, but there's another garage just behind it, and it's free.
I mean, how close it is never really mattered to me since I drive to it anyhow.
But we will, in response to Mr. Huckabee, we have looked at a couple of hotel sites, you know, close by, and also looked at hotel sites, a couple of hotels there at the airport that have meeting facilities, and they're fairly reasonable. We could always do that. So it's not like this is a group of 100. A small conference room at a hotel, those are always available.
Any other discussion about meeting? Do we need to have a discussion about the audit committee meeting, or does that the timing of that not matter?
We will get in touch with Dean on that, but we just need to double check that date. I'd have to look at the calendar real quick, see when we have that scheduled. Let me just flip to it.
Right now it's scheduled for the 18th. You talked about moving it since it would be virtual.
Yeah. We can scoot that back to probably 2 weeks ahead, and we'll just have to check schedules. But we can do that with the members of the committee. We don't have to do that right now.
Okay. Well, I guess the last issue we have to address is the fact that this is Robin's final meeting with us, whom we are going to miss very much.
Thank you, Jim. I have truly enjoyed working with all of you. You're a great group of professionals that come together, most of you on your own time, for a good cause. And I remember all those years ago when David Kester asked me if I wanted to be on the board, and I said, well, what do they do? And he said, well, they eat good. And I was like, okay, well, there you go. But then I had a meeting with Bart and learned all about what y'all do. And I've enjoyed being a part of that process these last few years. So thank you for letting me participate on the board. And I'm going to miss you all. And I know you will all continue to do great things.
Robin, thank you for your service. This was great. We'll miss you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Patty.
Robin, thanks so much. And put me down for two tickets to the matinee with some of those dots in the background.
That's the theater room back there. You know, when we built this house, we knew it was going to be our retirement home, so we didn't put an office in here. Having to work from home or participate in these type of meetings, I'm sitting in the dining room. So I know Bart had said something to me earlier and I didn't respond back. I just kind of waved. It's because my husband was walking through the house saying some four-letter words about something else that he was working on. And I had to keep it muted, Bart. Sorry, I didn't respond. But,
that's okay.
You didn't want to hear what was being said in the other room.
Well, I have to repeat a little what I said yesterday, but Robin has spent an inordinate amount of time as a public member on some very significant issues and brought some expertise on a number of personnel issues. And I think perspective on all the issues that we have before the committee. So your professionalism, your dedication, commitment to the service you provide has just been admirable. And I'm going to miss you. And I thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I'd like to echo those sentiments as someone who's worked for a lot of years with the personnel committee. I would commend Director Vincent and thank her for her past leadership and service.
Thank you, Shelby.
Robin, it's James. I also echo those comments, and I've had the opportunity to serve with you on the Texas Public Risk Management Board for a number of years. Your friendship, your professionalism, I've always admired that. And if you're feeling lonely, we could consider having a board meeting at your house.
Hey, I have a dining room table that'll seat 10, so we could do that.
Yeah, Robin, well, good luck to you, my friend, and enjoy your retirement.
Thank you. We have to add, just because you're leaving the board, these are public meetings. You can come to as many as you like.
We will check your sanity.
Yeah.
Robin, this is Dean. I really enjoyed working with you.
Thank you, Dean.
Thanks for everything, Robin.
Thank you, David. Thanks for serving on the personnel committee with James and I. You know, for a long time, it was a committee of two. We were thankful to have you join us. So now I guess you're back to a committee of two.
Thank you, Robin, and enjoy your retirement. You've set a high bar, too, for your successor as chair of the personnel committee. So
thank you, Jackie. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Yeah, and in case y'all were wondering, I think Bart said we have the next meetings in January of the personnel committee. So at the October board meeting, we'll address the vacancy on the personnel committee and try to get it back up to three. But
the bylaws allow for any vacancy on the board that the board at a meeting can fill the vacancy. And I'd like to post it as an agenda item rather than just have it be an extra thing. So it'll be posted to address the vacancy on the personnel committee.
Okay. Well, again,
Mr. Chair.
Robin. Yeah.
Yeah. So attendant to the discussion of fulfilling board seats and fulfilling chairmanships or committee heads, as well as the issues surrounding where we might be holding meetings going forward. This is admittedly a self-serving comment, but also one that hopefully might be considered in the vein of how we attract talent onto this board going forward. Just an observation on my part. So we appreciate that the Texas Association is perhaps one of, if not the most difficult associations to recruit board members due to law requiring release of personal financial data. So we have a hard time as it is. We don't pay any of these folks for their service. We require them more than most other states require them, both in terms of time and toil and personal reporting. Just an observation on my part, we're saving money now with respect to our lease space. I fully appreciated that when we had nice facilities that we felt the need to avail ourselves of those facilities when meeting. Now that we don't have those, and now that we're saving those dollars, I'll tell you that of the five boards I sit on. One of them is perhaps below Texas, but the other three above Texas in terms of how of an attractive benefit, perhaps, of participating in the board by virtue of arranging meetings in nice places or at least nice venues. So in Florida and in Georgia and in Washington, each of those states, their annual meeting is held at some sort of a resort or a nice hotel with nice facilities. So at least there's some appreciation given to board members and perhaps a carrot for those considering the board to feel like that they're rewarded for their time and toil with some a nice venue. I'll admittedly say that New York falls way behind Texas and that we meet in a law firm in Manhattan for a couple of hours and that's it. Maybe we get a cookie and a coffee. So I'm not saying it's the norm across the country, but I am saying a consideration for us perhaps going forward if we continue to have trouble. I don't know that this is going to win folks over, but at least a nice thing as a tribute to those serving.
So I don't mean to bring up a tough subject, but are we having trouble recruiting or are we having trouble getting the department to appoint somebody?
Well, I've spoken with Caitlin Merrick a little bit, and last week she was on the call with us. Caitlin is in that unit of the Texas Department that they fill these boards, and public member vacancies. They have public members on a number of different boards. I think there are, I can't even recall, 9 or 10 different boards. The commissioner has responsibility to appoint members. They have trouble finding enough public members, and I don't know if it's, if the enticement that Director Kennedy mentions might help. We are a little different from those other associations because we have in-person meetings quarterly, or that's been our standard, rather than an annual meeting. We have no annual meetings, not required in our statute. So we are slightly different, but we have held meetings in other locations. And as long as we designate the meeting location and file it with the Texas Secretary of State, we can meet in any location. So it's something I can easily talk to Caitlin and her associates at the Texas Department in the division that makes these appointments to see if an enticement, you know, what can we do to help them find directors?
And how many public spots do we have open?
We have one public spot and one small company spot. I mean, I say that. I'm so sorry, Robin. You're not gone yet. I apologize. We will have a small company spot and a public member spot.
Did we, you know, I had recommended a candidate for the small company spot. Did that fall through or have we heard anything from TDI on that?
I haven't heard anything. And that's not unusual that I don't hear anything.
I don't really tell us much.
I may check in on it, I guess. I assume that was moving forward, but I'll check.
If I can just mention allowing hybrid meetings might make it easier to recruit people now.
Yeah.
That
following up on Jim's question, or is there difficulty in recruiting people? Just FYI, industry member was elected for the TPC board, approved by the commissioner. This person was from Travelers and then found out about the personal financial filing requirement and respectfully declined to follow through with service.
Have they ever looked at it? It is so benign and ridiculously uninformative. I'm surprised people won't do it.
Well, I would say, Jim, this was a very accomplished person, a lawyer. And when she reviewed it personally,
okay.
I think those requirements can be interpreted in different ways, but she was concerned about having to divulge information, not only with regard to her, but to her with regard to her husband.
Okay.
Shelby, I've had several members of the industry contact me about wanting to serve on the Texas board. I've discussed that with them, and I've sent them the forms to review. And after reviewing the forms, they said, no, I'm not interested.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they even require the form, because it reveals so little useful information. It's kind of funny. The one I have to do just as a board member and owner of my insurance company is a real financial statement, where this one is, I'd love to do the one that we do for the Guaranty Association as an owner of an insurance company. That's just surprising.
Well, the form is so ill-suited for detecting conflict of interest with regard to the Guaranty Association. It's a one form fits all for legislators, for judges. And, you know, apparently legislatively, these attempts to try to change the law have been dead on arrival, because, you know, the reaction is, oh, what are you trying to hide? But it would seem to be, you know, another alternative is trying to get a rule from the Texas Ethics Commission to carve out directors who come together four times a year, instead of treating them substantially equivalent to a legislator or a judge or other public official.
And Jim, this is something that could be followed up with the next commissioner. As you recall, there was a prior commissioner that was willing to go with us to the Ethics Commission and ask that form be changed for this board. He said, once it's in the law, you're not taking it out of the law, so we can't remove the filing requirements, but it seems like it could be amended, because the requirements and the purpose for this board compared to a judge or an elected official are completely different. But Mike left office, and that was Mike Geisland, and there has been no appetite to pursue that since.
And Bart, this is Ted again. I just to put the button on this, I didn't want to open a whole can of worms. I just thought a suggestion. It sounded as though we may be finding ourselves in at some point future in a circumstance in which we're moving toward having our quarterly meetings offsite, so to speak, with respect to a hotel. And my suggestion was only if we're going to be going to some sort of residence in Austin, then we might just as well go out to the Omni Barton Creek or to the Hyatt Lost Pines and have a nice venue, and that might be an appeal to some.
Yeah.
Hey, so how many years do you have to be out of the insurance industry before you can serve as a public?
I would have to pull up the requirements, Jim. I don't know if there's a time requirement. It's just if you have any interest, and it spells out what your interest to the industry. You're not, so I don't think there's a time requirement, but I'll have to check, Jim.
I don't recall there being a time requirement.
So if somebody retires from the insurance industry and they wanted to serve on the Guaranty Association board, they would not be a public member, not a industry member?
It would depend on what interest they have in insurance companies, what licenses they have. He's an agent or a lobbyist, things like, there are a few other things like that you have to kind of check off.
Well, maybe if you could send that to me, I might be able to find a public person if I knew what the disqualifications were.
Okay, I'll send it to you.
I remember we looked at this several years ago after Ron Downing left the board, and there was an idea about asking or seeing if he could join as a public member, and what conflicted with that was that his wife was an active insurance agent on property casualty side, and maybe she was the owner of her agency. I don't really remember what the details were right now, but I think when I looked at that question then, had his wife not been involved in the industry, then it looked as though he wouldn't be able to be eligible to serve as a public member at that point.
Well, okay. We will explore that, Jim, but I think Ted makes a good point. we'll look at those opportunities as well. And there are several.
This is James. Just one quick comment, following up what Ted said. I remember my years when I served as a public member on the surplus line staffing board. And it was a real treat. One of our quarterly meetings a year, we would always meet at the University of Texas at the stadium in a meeting room. But we would go to the University of Texas club for lunch. And it was always a very nice venue. You know, we do a good dinner once a year for the board members with our association and there's and if their spouses come. But every meeting, we, you know, we're kind of like eating on the fly, grabbing a plate, you know, stomping something down and getting back to the airport on the highway. But it would be nice if there was one meeting a year that is not as long or a marathon meeting. And I know that could depend on what happens in our industry. But at least that one meeting a year, we knew that we would not have sandwiches or catered meal in the conference room. We would actually be at the University of Texas club, and it was a shorter meeting, but we were able to enjoy a good meal with each other and not just grab a plate or something and run. So again, I know that depends on the agenda, but that was always a nice treat to know we had that one quarterly board meeting where we could actually, you know, have a decent a great meal and a little bit of time to publish it for one another.
Thank you, Jim. That's been noted.
Yeah. Thanks, Ted and Jim. Those are good ideas. Well, does anybody else have anything they want to talk about? I guess we can adjourn the meeting. One last time, thank you very much, Robin.
Thank you, Jim. Enjoyed working with you.
Okay, the time is 11:17 p.m. on July 27, 2021, and this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association that has been held pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act is adjourned.